Hello, listener. Welcome to episode 8 of Stems and Leaves. This is a show where we discuss intersectional stories in STEM. For the past few episodes, I've welcomed some wonderful guests on to share stories about how their identities have impacted the work they do in science, technology, engineering, math, and everywhere in between. It's been really wonderful to hear from women of all ages and backgrounds discussing how their race, gender, sexuality, and more have affected their work. And more importantly, the examples they gave of overcoming challenges and finding ways to be their fullest selves no matter what the context. For the next few episodes, we're going to step back from interviews for a little bit. School is back in session, I'm starting a new job soon, so it's going to be really important to find the balance between classes, work, research, and my passion project, this podcast. I've been tinkering with some ideas to keep bringing you content that's both relevant to the show and relating to some of the work that I'm doing in my life. I'd like to be able to share cool things that I'm churning up in my research, interesting stories about spaces where identities are being supported and celebrated. And I want to spend a bit of time unpacking some of the big ideas and terminology we use when we talk about intersectionality. So among those couple ideas, I figure we've got some things to talk about. It'll be a bit of trial and error, but I hope you'll stick with me and join the conversation. Today, I want to share a really interesting article by Carolyn Chen. Chen is a postdoc researcher at the University of California, San Diego. This paper was published in January of this year, and it's titled Designing the Danceable City: How Residents in Beijing Cultivate Health and Community Ties Through Urban Dance. This article caught my attention because in recent months, I've become a lot more aware of research as a tool for exploration, especially beyond what I think most members of the general public or even a lot of undergrads sort of perceive research to be. I think for myself in particular, I used to think of research as a very technical and clinical thing. Like you've got a super specific question that you want to answer, and so you're running tests and you're in a lab and you're collecting data. And to me, it used to feel like a not very fun thing to do. And especially because the department that I study under has a lot of highly technically skilled researchers. So a lot of the papers that are published out of our department have to do with extremely technical topics, and the papers are about advanced spatiotemporal modeling or remote sensing, and the titles are super long and just like dense and full of information. And you get through the abstract and you're like, okay, that's good for me. But as I've been learning this past year, and as I've started a research assistant position myself, I've been developing a better understanding of what research really is and why it's meaningful to keep up with what's going on in research, even if it's a very like small field or just like a niche interest or just at your university. Keeping up with research is a very important part of just being aware of your environment and your society. But back to this article. Designing the Danceable City, it immediately caught my attention at the title. I mean, what is a danceable city? As a person raised in the Midwest, where dance culture to me entails like the square dancing lessons that were somehow part of our middle school phys ed curriculum, and like nowadays it's the weekend scene at local bars and clubs that I absolutely do not frequent. I didn't immediately recognize how design matters to dance and what that would look like on the scale of a city. Because immediately I thought, well, there's dance studios, and that's, you know, a very, like, super local measure. So I was pleasantly surprised to learn from this article the prevalence of an urban dance culture in China, specifically in Beijing. You know, urban dance is a way for individuals of all backgrounds and ages to come together and form community around a shared activity. I would liken it to bingo night with a lot more movin' and groovin'. And so Chen's research acknowledged that cities are places that should support health, survival, social contact, and vitality. They found that for nearly 100 million Chinese residents, urban dance has become a key component of their healthy lifestyle. So the origin of urban dance in China is a traditional folk dance called Yenge. It dates back thousands of years to the Song Dynasty. It's been widely practiced in rural areas for a very long time, but after the 1990s, it became popular in the city as an invigorating way to improve one's physical and mental health, while at the same time building stronger relationships among city inhabitants. The rise in popularity of this dance style can be attributed in part to economic and planning policy shifts in the 1990s. Those shifts caused a surge in relatively young retirees through mass layoffs. While this demographic shift was occurring, there was also a huge rise in self-help movements among retirees because healthcare costs were rising, they weren't allowed to work, and they had more free time than ever. So a lot of movements to improve health were being generated, and so Yenge was one of these movements. Although nowadays it is actually referred to as square dancing in China, not to be confused with the American U.S. yeehaw style of square dancing. But the dance itself is very fun to watch. Participants will organize themselves in rows and a leader stands at the front. The dancers follow the leader's sequence and sometimes add their own flair as they see fit. Some groups add props like fans or very brightly colored scarves as to like enhance the movements of their choreography. And these groups are usually accompanied by live music and not like a huge big band. They'll play traditional Chinese instruments. So an instrument that is a Chinese horn, cymbals, gongs, and most importantly, drums. So it's, you know, just a super rich cultural experience and an energizing way for retirees in cities to get connected and get out and get moving. But interestingly, these dance groups don't have dedicated spaces, and they tend to be a little bit nomadic, moving around the city as spaces become available or they get kicked out. Chen's study found that these groups vastly prefer to dance in parks, because it's cleaner air and more beautiful surroundings, but they tend to get in trouble for dancing in these spaces. For one, parks in China and in Beijing are very popular, so they tend to run into other park users and have a conflict with who is going to use this space. Another issue is that they tend to be noisier. I mean, you're playing some cymbals and drums and you've got this great beat going, and that might be, you know, an impediment to someone else who's using the park to quietly reflect. So sometimes they get kicked out of parks, and their next sort of go-to space to use are transportation infrastructures. For example, like bridge underpasses. This is another common place that these groups end up practicing, because spaces like this in planning are commonly called waste spaces, because there is little use or economic benefit associated with them. However, there's still some resistance to these dance groups using these waste spaces, again, because of noise issues and that there might be some conflict with transportation users. And in fact, the complaints have gotten so severe that the central government and a lot of municipal governments are attempting to place bans and like heavy restrictions on urban dancing. But these dance groups are meeting these bans and restrictions head on because every year more and more people are getting involved in this urban dance almost as a form of resistance. So what does this mean in terms of urban planning? In Chen's article, the author describes a need for design that is responsive to the needs of its users. Chen suggests that urban planning in Chinese cities should find new methods that accommodate for the needs of these dance groups while not being obstructive to other users of these spaces. So they need to find, you know, new methods that find flat ground for these dancers to practice on and maybe, you know, new physical forms or technologies that can minimize the dispersion of noise. And in addition to, you know, altering some of these physical forms, there's also an adjustment to be made in terms of like place behavior. So instead of just considering a park a place for, you know, a picnic or like very light recreation, why can't some adjustments be made to accommodate these dancing retirees? Or in regards to the waste spaces, what amount of cleaning up and greenery can we add to enhance these spaces and give dancers a more wholesome environment to practice in? So Chen's article unpacks all of these things in detail, and if you've got 20, 25 minutes to give it a quick read, I would highly recommend it. Beyond some of the physical location data that Chen was able to gather that in and of itself was very interesting, the project used several surveys to gauge the attitudes and opinions of individuals in these dance groups, and it was so humanizing to see some of the feedback that these individuals were offering to this researcher. People were coming and joining these dance groups for all reasons. You know, some people were lonely and wanted some community. Some people, you know, wanted to improve their health. Some people were just bored and had nothing else to do. But it was just so just the essence of humanity to sort of read parts of this article. And it made me just like want to book a ticket to Beijing and find the nearest park. But again, if you'd like to read, there is a link to this article, Designing the Danceable City, down in the description. And also over at stemsandleaves.com, where you can leave a comment about your thoughts. Is there an urban dance culture where you're from? What solutions and compromises do you think that these cities could or should be making? And would you join a group like this? Leave a comment and join the conversation. So that's going to do it for this episode. If you'd like to hear more, every episode and links to listen can be found over at stemsandleaves.com or anywhere you listen to podcasts. Please leave me some comments and share the things that you find interesting. New science, cool math theories, advocacy groups, networking events, or anything at all. You can also send in comments, questions, suggestions, and your own stories to Emmy, E-M-M-E, at stemsandleaves.com. And this show would not be possible without the work of some awesome artists. The album art for this podcast was created by Aaron Thomas Art. A link to his website is available in the description. And also, thank you to Rosie Ross for the use of our theme song, Feelin' Fool. Links to their music are in the description as well. And thanks to you, listener, for joining me this episode. I hope you learned something new. I'll see you again in 2 weeks with another episode and new things to share. This has been Stems and Leaves. I'm Emmy. Stay curious.